Dr. Dixon Mann, in his book Forensic Medicine, one of the well-known textbooks on the subject, 1922 edition, tells of a case of a woman who was reduced to a heap of charred bones, and yet a tablecloth 3 feet away from this pile of ashes was not scorched at all. In other words, it was not fire around her burning her up. It was fire from within. Now, the ordinary chemical fire is a matter of oxidation. The oxygen in the air combines with chemical elements capable of being oxidized, and the process produces a lot of heat. But it also takes a lot of fuel. And a fire sufficient to cremate a human body within a house. Why, of course, it'd have the whole room in flames in the matter of 2-3 minutes and burn the whole house down. And burning the house down wouldn't cremate the body, because you know yourself, you have read in the many instances of people being burned to death where houses burned down, and the bodies, while they were charred beyond recognition, you couldn't recognize an individual person. The whole body was there. It wasn't just a pile of ashes, and it wasn't just a heap of bone. It was charred and blackened on the outside, but it had not been burned up. All right, let's take a few well-authenticated instances. In the month of December 1885, near Seneca, Illinois, Mrs. Patrick Rooney, a woman weighing over 250 pounds, was the one who burned up. Her husband and a hired man on the farm were in the house. The hired man, tired, went to bed in his room on the second floor early, closed the door. Mrs. Rooney and her husband were still down in the kitchen at that time. When he got up the next morning, it was before dark, he went down to the kitchen and he tried to strike a match on the stove, and the match wouldn't strike because the stove was covered with a greasy film. So he struck it with his thumbnail and saw a very curious sight. The walls and ceiling of the kitchen were covered with a black, oily, or greasy soot. He found Mr. Rooney, a couple of rooms away, dead, and the coroner's inquest showed that he had suffocated, died of smoke inhalation. There was a hole burned in the kitchen floor, and looking down to the ground below that hole, he saw a charred skull, a part of one vertebrae, 1 foot, and a mound of ashes. The rest of the body was just powdery ashes. Now, there was no fire in the house, no sign of heat, except where this hole had been burned in the floor, and only slight scorching on a tablecloth not far from this hole. So it wasn't fire from outside that had consumed her. It was fire from inside, which therefore could not be the normal chemical fire. This has to be something of an electrical nature. In the year 1938, there were 19 cases of this sort reported by British newspapers. For example, September 19, 1938, at Chelmsford, England, a woman dancing on a public dance floor suddenly burst into flames, which they were not able to put out, and within minutes was a mass of ashes. Now, we've all heard of instances where somebody's clothing caught fire, and it produced fatal burns. But it didn't burn a 1/16 of an inch deep in the skin. That is, it killed the skin from the heat, but it didn't consume it a 1/16 of an inch deep. And this woman burned up. April 7th, 1938, on the freighter, the steamship Ulrich, cruising off the coast of Ireland, the ship began veering off its course. So the second mate went up to the pilot house, and he found the helmsman, the man who had been there holding that big wooden steering wheel of the ship, burnt to ashes. Now, there'd been no outcry from him. There was no fire in the pilot house, no charred or scorched spots. Even the helmsman's shoes were not burnt. But ashes and cinders were all that remained of him. Now, evidently, when that sort of thing hits, it either produces immediate unconsciousness or at least immediately short-circuits the nerves so no pain is felt, because in none of these instances, apparently, was there any outcry, any shouts for help or anything. On that same day, a truck driving along the road veered off into a ditch where it came to a halt. This was near Upton by Chester, England. So when people went up and opened the door of the cab of the truck, the incinerated remains of the driver were found there. The glass windows in the truck cab were not cracked. On the upholstery, over on the passenger's side of the seat, there were grease stains which had not ignited. And there was no fire in the truck. No evidence of fire any place except right where the driver had been. The upholstery of the seat beneath his body was scorched, but the cab had not taken fire. March 1st, 1953, near Greenville, South Carolina, people along a road saw a sedan parked beside the road with smoke starting to come out of it. It suddenly made a jerky start, ran a short distance, veered off the road, going down an embankment and turning over a couple of times. Well, passing motorists rushed up there as fast as they could, and some of them had fire extinguishers, which they used. They opened the door. They found the charred body of the driver. Now, the heat inside the car had been so intense, plastic fittings had melted, the windshield glass had started to bubble, but all the fire damage was confined to this front seat where the driver had been. Gas tank was intact, had not ignited, no fire in the car except the fire in the driver. Remember, all these things went to coroner's inquests, so you have the definite official records of these things. In May 1953 in Los Angeles, Esther Doolin, last seen sitting in an overstuffed chair in her living room. The heat, when her body burned, was so intense that both her body and the chair were reduced to ashes. A hole was burned through the floor, and the ashes fell into the room below. But there was no other fire damage in the house. Now, there are cases where people fall asleep smoking in bed or in an upholstered chair, and the cigarette drops and sets fire to the upholstery. But you'll find this cloth upholstery stuffed with cotton does not flame up. It smolders. And if you're asleep or drunk and you're on this smoldering thing for a long time, you can receive serious and even fatal burns. But you aren't cremated. In fact, in some of these inquests, they had manufacturers of furniture and mattresses and so on in to testify, and they all said it would be impossible for the burning of a mattress or an upholstered chair to cremate anybody, because all it gets is a slow smoldering. It produces heat enough to give fatal burns, but not heat enough to consume flesh. on the night of July 1st and 2nd, 1951, at St. Petersburg, Florida. Mrs. Mary Reeser was last seen sitting in an overstuffed chair in her living room, clad in a nightgown, housecoat, and slippers. The next morning, her landlady came over to deliver a message, and there was a tiny bit of smoke drifting out an open window. Not a great volume, but a little bit of smoke, and the landlady was suspicious, so she called a neighbor, and they went in. Here's what they found. The apartment was very hot inside, very hot air, some smoke. The only fire was a small flame in the archway between the living room and the dinette. On the beam across the top, there was a little flicker of flame, a small flame burning there. No other fire in the room at all. Then they found this curious thing. About 4 feet off the floor, there was a level line all the way around the room. Above that line, the walls and ceiling were black with an oily soot. Below that, no smoke damage, no evidence of heat at all. Above that level, a plastic plate over an electric switch had melted. Below that 4 foot level, no evidence, as I say, of any heat. No furniture damaged below that line. On the concrete floor, there was about a 4 foot diameter circle, blackened, and the carpet burned away. And this 4 foot blackened circle had a film of grease on it. And in this blackened circle lay the wire coiled springs from the upholstery of the chair, a pile of blackened ashes, and only this much of the body, a charred liver attached to a short section of spine, a charred and shrunken skull, 1 foot still wearing a satin slipper, but the foot had burned off on the ankle, nothing more. Paint on the wall near that spot was not scorched, and a pile of newspapers 1 foot away from this circle was not even scorched. In other words, in all these instances, there was no fire outside the body. There was fire inside the body consuming it. You know, just spending a little while listening to a left-wing Jew professor in our universities doesn't always tell you all the mysteries of science. There are things they still have to find out about. Dr. Wilton M. Krogman, professor of physical anthropology at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine, testified in one of these cases, "It takes terrific heat to totally consume a human body. I have watched a body in a crematorium burn at 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit for over 8 hours under the best conditions, and yet at the end of that time there was scarcely a bone that was not present and completely recognizable as a human bone. The bones were canceled, were calcined, but they were not ashes or powder." He is the greatest expert in the United States on the effects of fire on the human body. He has often worked with the FBI and police departments as an expert where someone has died of burns under circumstances that might be murder. So he is a well-known expert on it. So these things show definitely that this kind of fire is not the usual chemical oxidation fire. Now, somebody said that a miracle is an occurrence according to perfectly natural laws that we don't yet know about. And this is an example of it, because it is evident that beside the ordinary oxidation type of fire, the chemical fire, there are also electrical fires of a totally different nature. So as far as the wicked being taken care of, yes, even if they hide in the good concrete bomb shelter, God has ways of reaching them. Now as to our protection during that time, you've got plenty of matter in the Bible that promises you protection. For example, Isaiah 33, verses 14 to 19. And again, Moffat's translation seems to be the best. In Zion, sinful men are terrified. The impious are seized with shuddering, crying, "Oh, who can live with such a devouring fire? Who can live on with such a lasting flame?" Who? "He who scorns to profit by oppression, he who will not clutch at any bribe, he who listens to no plans of murder, he who will not look at crime, he who lives uprightly, just in word and deed, he shall dwell far out of reach of harm, as in a stronghold on the cliff, secure, his bread provided and his water sure." And remember, Isaiah 43, verse 2, "When thou passest through the waters, I will be with thee, and through the rivers, they shall not overflow thee. When thou walkest through the fire, thou shalt not be burned, neither shall the flame kindle on thee." But are you going to be skeptical about that? Well, the answer is you don't have to be, because again, we have well proven instances within our own time. The best known of these, perhaps, is Daniel Douglas Home, an English spiritualist medium whose work was between 1833 and 1866. Now, I've got nothing favorable to say about the man for being a spiritualist medium, because, of course, the Bible condemns that. But somehow or other, he demonstrated as much ability to withstand flame as if he'd been made of steel. Many times in public, he showed his ability to handle fire without being burned. And I might say that all the greatest scientists of the day, being skeptical, came to see these things, and they couldn't provide any explanation either. There was no fake about it. The Earl of Crawford wrote this: "I have frequently seen Home, when in a trance, go to the fire, take out red-hot coals, carry them about in his hands, put them inside his shirt, and so on." Another noted scientist, Sir William Crookes. Any of you who wear glasses with a little tint in them to cut down the brightness of the sunlight are probably using a glass invented by Sir William Crookes. He's one of the important scientists of his age. Here's what he wrote: "Mr. Home went to the fire, and after stirring the hot coals about with his hand, took out a red-hot piece nearly as big as an orange, and putting it in his right hand, covered it with his left hand so as to almost completely enclose it, and then blew into the small furnace thus extemporized until the lump was nearly white-hot, and drew my attention to the lambent flame which was flickering over the coal and licking around his fingers. He fell upon his knees, looked up in a reverent manner, and said, 'Isn't God good? Aren't his laws wonderful?'" Now, exactly how and why that power was given to this man, I don't know. I can't explain it. But definitely it was there, because it was done in the presence and under the careful examination of some of the greatest scientists of the 19th century. And they weren't able to find any explanation at all, nor any evidence of trickery of any kind. So, first, when the Bible says there's going to be judgment by fire, it means what it says. It's real fire. It's not limited to the little things man can do, and even his biggest hydrogen bomb is little on the scale of the things God made. It can come in the form of flames that burn up thousands of square miles at a time. And as I say, if the wicked want to go hide in their underground concrete bomb shelters, God has a way of taking care of them even there. And as for those of us who are not the enemies of God, there's nothing to get gray hairs about, because he's promised us he will bring us through this safely. And it's not superstition. We have seen within our own period of time that this thing can be done and has been done. So, as always, the Bible's right.
My subject today is the men of his own house. It is clear to all students of Bible prophecy that we're now in the last days of this age, the time of the end. We know this because we recognize in the conditions surrounding us and in the principal events of current history, the things which the prophet said would be the signs of the end of the age. Among these signs are the gathering of the heathen nations against the Christian nations and their preparation to conquer us in battle if they can. But there is another and far more sinister sign, and it is also one which the prophet said would be a sign of the end, and that is the danger from internal subversion. God has set his own children, the sons and daughters of Anglo-Saxon Israel, apart from the rest of the world. They were put here for a purpose, to know their Father, their God, to worship him only, to know his laws and to obey them, and to demonstrate to the rest of the world what great blessings come to those who do worship and obey the only true God. You who listen to this program know that the children of Israel are today known as the Anglo-Saxon nations of the world. The Germanic, Scandinavian, British, and Celtic peoples found in Germany, Norway, Denmark, Sweden, Finland, Holland, the British Isles, including Ireland, Scotland, and Wales, and in their former colonies, the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa. Not all of these people, as individuals, have lived up to this obligation, as we know. But these nations as a whole have lived up to it to a degree which has set them apart among all the nations of the world. Because they have in general been faithful to their God, they have also received the benefits which he promised to them. Truly, they have received the blessing promised in Genesis 27, verses 28 and 29. God give thee of the dew of heaven and the fatness of the earth, and plenty of corn and wine. Let people serve thee, and nations bow down to thee. Be lord over thy brethren, and let thy mother's sons bow down to thee. Cursed be everyone that curseth thee, and blessed be he that blesses thee. In short, by reason of the blessings given them by our God, the Anglo-Saxon peoples have become the have-nations of the world, while the pagan nations have been the have-not nations, even though they are living on land rich in natural resources, resources which have not been developed unless we have done it for them. Naturally, they envy us most bitterly for all this. They hate us even for the things we have shown them how to do. It is no cause for surprise that they now are joining together against us, hoping to destroy us and steal our wealth. But it is also true that our greatest danger is not from these external enemies, but from the traitorous enemies from within. And this also is a fulfillment of Bible prophecy and a sign of the time of the end. Jesus Christ mentioned it, among other places, in his parable of the tares among the wheat, that the enemies, the sons of Satan, would be living among us and doing their deadly work here in our own land, right down to the very end, when the angel reapers would take them out and burn them. And Jesus Christ identified these sons of Satan in John chapter 8, verses 31 to 44. I suggest you read it again. Meanwhile, the angels are fulfilling the prophecy by gathering the tares in bundles. That is, the opponents of Christianity and of God's kingdom are being gathered into the various left-wing organizations. But as I have said before, the Bible is always true to its own law of the two witnesses. What one prophet says is confirmed by the writings of another prophet, written centuries before or centuries later. Therefore, we find, as we would expect, confirmation in other parts of the Bible. For example, Psalm 74 is a prayer of God's people Israel for his help in a time of great peril. They tell him, "Thine enemies roared in the midst of thy congregations. The tumults of those that rise up against thee increases continually." Surely this is true today. The enemies of our God roar out their hatred of us and our God, even from within his own congregations, which they have infiltrated and corrupted. They fight bitterly to keep his name from being mentioned in our schools. They threaten lawsuits against any city council, school board, or other governing body which would allow any kind of religious service on public property. They object even to having any session of an official body opened with prayer. By their own admission, they are the enemies of our God. But these same ones, whom Jesus Christ identified as the sons of their father, the devil, are also the enemies of our nation and our American way of life. Everything which has made us great, they denounce as belonging to the horse and buggy days. They call it reactionary, and they attack as fascists and extreme right wing all those who seek to preserve the virtues which made us the freest, the most prosperous, and the most powerful nation in all world history. They put evil pressure on our congressmen and senators to enact laws and approve treaties which would completely destroy our independence and make us a conquered province of the United Nations, without power to control our political relation with other nations or our trade with them, or even to forbid pagan and hostile races from pouring in upon us by the millions until we're swamped under the incoming tidal wave of other races. Aliens who will then rule us in our own country. The prophet Micah knew the score. In chapters 2 and 3, he describes the evil deeds of these tares among the wheat. In chapter 5, he prophesies the attack upon us by the armies of the enemy from outside. But in chapter 7, verse 6, he warns us that in these times, a man's enemies are the men of his own household. Truly inspired is this connection of the threat of invasion from without at the time of the end, and the fact that the real enemies are those of our own household. Jesus Christ confirms this, for in Matthew 10, verses 34 to 36, he warns us, "Think not that I am come to send peace on earth. I came not to send peace, but a sword. And a man's foes shall be they of his own household." While the evil originates with the tares among the wheat, the sons of their father, the devil, they know how to dress it up in false colors until even some of the children of Israel are deceived. Evil never makes much headway when it sails under its true colors, but when it is falsely represented as good, it will deceive many who are not among God's elect. Therefore, these evil doctrines have made quite a number of converts among our people who should know better. Accordingly, Jesus Christ warned that there would be many of the children of the kingdom who would be cast out into outer darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. The purposes of prophecy are two. First, to serve as a warning of what is to come for the benefit of all who will believe it and act upon it. By his belief in prophecy, Noah saved himself and his family from the flood. But there have been many books of religion and of prophecy written, making it difficult to know which were genuine and which were false. Therefore, the second purpose of prophecy is to prove which are the truly inspired works and which are the forgeries. In Isaiah 41, verse 23, God challenges the other religions, "Show the things that are to come hereafter, that we may know that ye are gods." They couldn't, so their claims and their writings have been rejected. But our Bible has proved itself by the fulfillment of prophecies many times over thousands of years. Its genuineness is beyond question by any reasonable man who has carefully read it and compared it with history. Therefore, the warnings in its prophecies addressed to us in these days should be taken very seriously. When Micah was able to point out the chief danger we face today, writing of it almost 2,700 years ago, we are foolish indeed if we fail to heed him. It has always been the fate of those who have believed God and heeded his warning that they have been ridiculed and even bitterly hated by those who must learn all terrible lessons the hard way. And this is true today. We are called fanatics, bigoted, extremists, and other things even less polite. Nevertheless, the events of the day vindicate those who have heeded God's warning and opened their eyes to realities. It surely is true in these days of desperate and increasing danger that our worst enemies are those who live within our own national household. Those who have scoffed at prophecy have finally paid the penalty all through the centuries. Pray that our nation will wake up and take warning while yet there remains time. Today I want to talk about the day of his preparation. The various Bible prophecies deal with many events occurring at different times. Some of these are already past, completely fulfilled. Others are on such a grand scale that they seem to have a double fulfillment, a partial one in the past, a greater one in the future, while others deal only with events which even now are still in the future. Which of these speak of our own times? The only ones still awaiting fulfillment are those which deal with the end of the present age and the coming of the kingdom of God. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, Joel, Nahum, Zechariah, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and Revelation all contain major prophecies concerning our own times. They make it clear that the present age will end in terrific violence. Look about you and see why. Despite the good intentions of the few, despite the general acceptance of Christianity by the white nations of the world, yet the present world order is satanic in its major outlines, and even the white Christian nations have been infiltrated and corrupted by the anti-Christians. To seek coexistence with evil, to pray for peace on terms acceptable to Satan, is to turn our backs on Jesus Christ, who is the only source of real peace. The coming attack by Russia under anti-Christian leadership is clearly foretold in the Bible. Nearly two centuries ago, when Russia was too weak to be a menace, Bible students then identified Russia as being the great enemy in the 38th and 39th chapters of Ezekiel. When will this happen? The prophecies are not dated, but they state warning signs to watch for, signs that the time is at hand. And one of these is given by the prophet Nahum. In a strangely penetrating vision, he says this, "He that dashes in pieces is come up before thy face. Keep the munition, watch the way, make thy loins strong, fortify thy power mightily." That is, an enemy so powerful that he has shattered many nations now confronts us. We must stockpile munitions to be ready to meet his sudden attack. We must watch the way, that is, send out our U-2 airplanes to watch every way he might attack us, fortify our power mightily, set up a ring of air bases and rocket bases from which to rain destruction upon the attacker. But our military experts all warn us that we do not spend enough on our defenses, and they are certainly right. Well, why can't we spend more? You know why when you look at your own income tax bills for the last 20 years. We have already spent all we have. Our pockets are empty. We pay more taxes than all the rest of the free world combined. Our national debt is greater than the combined debts of all the rest of the world, including the communist half. Where has it gone? Billions of dollars of it have gone to strengthen the very enemies who now threaten war against us. And this also was prophesied. The future holds no secrets from God. 26 centuries ago, Nahum told us, the emptiers have emptied them out. You know who the emptiers have been, those who have falsely called themselves liberal when they were only liberal with other people's money. But even this evil masquerade was prophesied. The prophet Isaiah, in Isaiah 32, verse 5, speaking of the time after this age is ended, and when the kingdom of God then rules the world, says that then the vile, yes, that's V-I-L-E, the vile person shall be no more called liberal. This deliberate ruin of their own nation to carry out socialist policy is against the laws of God. Many prophets have warned against this. In Baruch 4, verse 3, we are warned, give not thine honor to another, nor the things that are profitable unto thee, to a strange nation. Ecclesiasticus 12, verse 5, warns us, give not to the ungodly, hold back thy bread, and give it not unto him, lest he overmaster thee thereby. Else thou shalt receive twice as much evil for all the good thou shalt have done unto him. In Deuteronomy 23, verse 6, God himself commands us, as to these other peoples, thou shalt not seek their peace nor their prosperity all thy days forever. So, because we disregard God's warning, your wages go down the rat holes of taxes and inflation. Truly, as the prophet Haggai said, he that earns wages to put into a bag with holes. But when is the attack coming, you ask? Well, let's go on with Nahum. He says, the chariot shall be with flaming torches in the day of his preparation. The chariot shall rage in the streets. They shall jostle one against another in the broad ways. They shall seem like torches. They shall run like the lightnings. This sign couldn't be understood until our time. Many of you can remember when few people could go anywhere except by streetcar or by train. Then came the automobile. It carried us to and from our work. It released us to wander the highways like gypsies, until, as the prophet Daniel said, many shall run to and fro. But how accurate is the quaint language of Nahum? The chariot shall rage in the streets. Go out on the main streets in and out of the big cities at the rush hours. Hear the angry horns. Watch the reckless drivers weave from lane to lane, shouting insults at whoever beats them to an opening in the mob. They shall jostle one against another in the broad ways, says Nahum. Isn't that why you pay for collision insurance, liability insurance, medical and hospital insurance? Then he says the chariot shall be with flaming torches. They shall seem like torches. They shall run like the lightnings. But the words translated torches really mean lamps, shining, throwing light. It could better be translated, the chariot shall be equipped with shining lamps. Drive the great highways at night and watch where oncoming traffic comes over the crest of a hill toward you, three or four lanes abreast, a great river of light flowing toward you. How accurately the prophet described these things 26 centuries before even the names for these things had been coined. But for what purpose is this vision? Is it just to anticipate our modern progress? Oh, no indeed. Nahum warns us that this occurs in the day of his preparation. Whose preparation? Our great enemy, about whom Nahum has been talking. Since the coming of the automobile, two great world wars have destroyed all the great empires except that of the beast kingdom of anti-Christian communism. We now see dictatorships more powerful, more evil and cruel than ever before in all history. And the invention of the atom and hydrogen bombs now gives stern meaning to Jesus Christ's warning that, except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved. It is no wonder that the prophet Habakkuk said of all this, "When I heard, my belly trembled, my lips quivered at the voice, and I trembled in myself, that I might be at rest in the day of trouble. When he comes up unto the people, he will invade them with his troops." In the day of his preparation, there must be our preparation also. We cannot cringe in cowardly submission to evil. Our purpose, our glorious destiny in this world, is to destroy evil. God has told us in Jeremiah 51, verse 20, "Thou art my battle axe and weapons of war. For with thee will I break in pieces the nations, and with thee will I destroy kingdoms." Again, in Isaiah 54, verse 17, "No weapon that is formed against thee shall prosper, and every tongue that shall rise against thee in judgment thou shalt condemn. This is the heritage of the servants of the Lord, and their righteousness is of me, saith the Lord." And in Isaiah 41, verse 10, "Fear thou not, for I am with thee. Be not dismayed, for I am thy God. I will strengthen thee, yea, I will help thee, yea, I will uphold thee with the right hand of my righteousness." This is no time for cowardice. All the hydrogen bombs in the world couldn't kill you any deader than an Indian's tomahawk or arrow could. Yet your great-grandfathers faced these dangers every day without fear. They tamed a hostile wilderness and built a great civilization. Are you unworthy to be their child? Do you expect to gain immortality by groveling at the feet of a red master? Remember that the list of those who are forever excluded from God's last great kingdom as being unworthy to enter it begins with the cowards. That's Revelation 21, verse 8. Only those with the courage to follow their God against all evil will be allowed to spend eternity with him. There is eternal truth in God's great words to Joshua. "Have not I commanded thee? Be strong and of a good courage. Be not afraid, neither be thou dismayed, for the Lord thy God is with thee wherever thou goest."
This tape was produced by Your Heritage of San Diego, California. We have much more information in written form and in tape recordings, both reel and cassette. This material is offered to the personal ministries of those who are called to awaken God's Israel sheep to the truth of His Word and the necessity for national repentance. We welcome your suggestions as to how Your Heritage can more effectively spread the gospel of Christ's earthly kingdom. Many people meeting in their homes are using our material to help in their studies. Such groups represent a healthy return to the form of assembly as practiced by the apostles and offers those who finally see the light and come out of the Babylonian denominational system a place to worship with other believers. As you know, Your Heritage is not associated with any organization. As our congregation, we depend upon your tithes and offerings to pay our expenses in spreading the gospel of the kingdom.
Please address all correspondence to our new private zip code, Your Heritage, San Diego, California, 92116-0100. Now goodbye, and may God richly bless you.